With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, this is Fee from South London, and you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. Now, my question is, which condiment could you live without? Okay, here comes the show. And remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, a.k.a. The Hizzer.
Hello.
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we're talking everything from...
Well, we're talking everything from Fee from South London's question, which condiment could you live without? Dane, are there any condiments that don't have significance for you that you could just let go?
Mayonnaise.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
I'm lactose intolerant, Howard. So, mayonnaise can go. And, you know, first of all, you can get vegan mayonnaise now anyway, Howard. Second of all, I feel like aioli is kind of made mayonnaise somewhat obsolete in certain socioeconomic groups as it is. And finally, like, I just don't know how you can make sauce from egg yolk. It's weird.
You make this entirely your own opinion. I'd go for mint sauce. I have no interest in mint sauce. I don't enjoy it on my lamb. I prefer mustard. Mint sauce is what I'd get rid of. And yeah, I suppose we answered that one there for Fee.
Yeah, Fee, you almost broke the group up. We're going to have to talk about this mayonnaise thing because you got really upset about that.
Oh, I've got a lot of time for mayonnaise.
Howard, can we compromise? I like Pyrenees, okay?
Okay, fine, done.
Gosh.
Well, Fee, suffice to say, on this show, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely. No matter how contentious they are, we are never afraid to confront the issues with these questions. And if you do like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify, and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all the questions from all our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show, our guest is a British comedian, actor, and rock musician. For his live comedy work, he's been nominated twice for Best Show at the Edinburgh Festival and has won a Chaucer Award, a British Comedy Award, and a Sky Arts Southbank Show Award. On TV, he was a star of BBC series Uncle and wrote, directed, and starred in BAFTA Award-nominated short Elephant. He has also released two successful albums of original music, which feature hit songs from his solo shows and are available on iTunes and Bandcamp. And he's also an all-round, very, very nice guy who never feels awkward. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Nick Helm!
It's me. You said awkward. You referenced one of my jokes. That's so sweet.
What?
Thank you very much.
Some good jokes there, Nick. How are you, Nick? How are you?
I'm all right. How are you, Dane?
I'm good, thank you. And I just wanted to add, because Howard helped me to comprise your bio, but I also want to add, Howard, a special story that the first time I went to Edinburgh, I was lucky enough to get a spot on the BBC showcase at the Potter Row, which was at 12 o'clock. And I got so excited about it that I turned up 12 hours early for it and didn't sleep. And then when I came back to do it again properly, because I was relatively green to the comedy industry, I was very nervous about performing at the BBC. And the first person that came up to me to calm my nerves was Nick Helm. And I remember that. That was in 2012. So always been an all-around nice guy, Nick. So it's very nice to see you.
I always thought that happened in Latitude for some reason, but yes, I remember.
It's because we had the trailers, that's why.
Yes, right, yeah. Oh, yeah, I always remember that. And I always say, you know, I get quite paranoid sometimes, and I think that everyone hates me, and then I always think, how could Dane hate me?
Never.
So great, thanks for having me on.
No problem. Nick's always been like, you know, when Dane finally does switch and goes on that killing spree, I'll be safe.
Yeah, I got in early with Dane. It's fine.
Yeah, you know when it all goes down, you'll be all right. When I'm in the top of that clock tower with that rifle, you can walk along whistling away, walking your dog, mate. Grab yourself a croissant.
Great, good. Good. All right. Brilliant.
Nick,
thank you.
Nick, where do you stand on the condiments issue? Are there any that you particularly don't need, or are you what are you feeling?
Right. So ask me the question.
Nick, which condiment could you live without?
Extra large. that's what I thought. But I also think that aioli is technically, it's a mayonnaise, isn't it? It's a garlic mayonnaise. And I also think that Piranese is technically a mayonnaise. And I think vegan mayonnaise is still a mayonnaise. So I understand what you're saying, Dane, but I would say that if mayonnaise is out, then mayonnaise is out, you know?
That's fair.
I don't want to get into an argument.
You said that you could live without it, though, so I'm just like saying it's gone. It's off the table.
Yeah, it's true. I could, yeah, exactly. That's true. I could live without it. I mean, as long as the rest of the world doesn't suffer. Because the thing is, I thought about a mustard, but I wasn't sure how the mustard umbrella works. Would it just be like French and like Dijon mustard, or would it be like English mustard, or what level would I be throwing away?
I think it would be all mustards. And I'm not really big on mustard, but sometimes it does call for... I could live without applesauce.
Interesting. Good. That's true. Yeah. That's true. Okay, cool.
I've never wanted applesauce.
I always think it's interesting how the chili sauce dynasty really grew with the sweet chili boom.
Sweet chili really turned the whole thing around. Between sweet chili, I'd say, and kebabs. And it's weird because I feel like sweet chili sensations really helped that, despite the fact that they're not actually a condiment in themselves.
No, so, absolutely.
Crisp, mate. Yeah.
Well, if you were to ask the question, what condiment could you not live without? Mm. Is that the way? Yeah. Mm. Then I would have to say chili sauce, because, you know, I can't live without chili sauce. I put that on everything.
It's a good choice. I was thinking I probably couldn't live without soy sauce.
Ooh. Oh, and soy sauce. Yes.
Yeah.
Soy sauce and chili sauce I could not live without. I could live without ketchup, maybe.
Ooh, that's good.
Not in its heyday.
I wouldn't choose to get rid of ketchup, but I could live without ketchup. I couldn't live without chili sauce.
I'd be devastated to never have McDonald's sweet and sour sauce again. That's a good... I love that sauce.
Poor. Do you know what? If you go to McDonald's, then the sweet curry sauce that they do at McDonald's is incredible.
Yeah. Well, Fee, you've inspired much debate. Thank you, Fee, from South London.
Absolutely. And I would like to advise all the listeners that I can't stress the importance of condiments enough. I mean, it can make the difference between eating a slice of toast and a sandwich.
Yeah, well said.
Rubber up, guys.
Yeah, that's right.
I've come back.
That's right, guys.
I've come back to not understanding what a condiment is.
But what if they had sauce flavored condiments, Nick? Would you, if there was a sweet Durex made sweet chili flavor, would you go for that?
Sweet chili flavor. Well. Sure. Okay. Yeah. If I'm sucking a dick. But I would just say I'm not really. Do you know what? If they were checked out, then I would just put sweet chili sauce on. I just don't know why I would. I would cut out the middleman.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would just eat hot chili sauce. I'd eat sweet chili sauce off the dick. I wouldn't.
Cover it in a. Yeah. All right. And then. Yeah. No, that makes sense.
Great. Well, we've all learned something from today's episode. Well, I hate to break this up, but unfortunately, we're going to have to go on to a question from our guest, Dane, format of this show dictates.
Or another question, I should say. But Nick Helmer, our very esteemed guest, we would invite you to ask a question, any question you would like, a question of any type, which we'd like to discuss for about 15 minutes, have a little talk about that. Howard will then ask a question, which we'll discuss for the same amount of time, and then lather, rinse, repeat. I would like to ask you a question, which we could discuss for 15 minutes and such. And then when we are done, you can let our audience know where they can find out about more about your good works, deeds, thoughts, and products. Sound like a plan?
That sounds great. I'm not massive on me going first, but yes, sure.
First guest to moan about that, but okay.
It's your format. Yeah, but do you know why? Because I haven't seen an extensive list of who else you've had on, but But I'm very sort of like gentlemanly. I'm always sort of like, you know, you go first, you know. So, so I imagine you've had absolute animals on.
Oh, yes. We have.
So,
Romesh, for a start, he came on this podcast. Yeah, he was getting mental ramblings about someone stealing his hot sauce. The guy has a chip on his shoulder.
Well, what was his question?
His question was about, is he too old to buy trainers, to buy, have a trainer collection?
Oh, right. It was like that, was it? Okay, fine. I'm sure you got a lot of lessons. good. All right, so are you waiting for me to ask my question then?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've just got to come out and ask my question.
That would be great, yeah.
All right. Okay, here's my question. What's your fucking problem?
I can go first.
I like it. Let's go with it. Feel free. What's your fucking problem?
What's my fucking problem? My problem is, I don't know where to begin. Where do you want me to start? I mean, everything's just, the world's a fucking hard place to live in, right? Doesn't it drive you up the wall? Like every day. I have to remind myself to stop getting annoyed. That's like the level I'm at with what my fucking problem is. Like, you know, and I get annoyed at things I don't need to care about.
But what is your problem?
Oh. That's very good. It's existential, Howard.
Is it your fucking problem, Howard? is that you think everything that's happening in the world is happening to you? And that if you thought about it more on like a global scale, you could let go a little bit and you could kind of like put things in a bit more perspective. Maybe that's your problem. I don't know.
It's a really good analysis.
I just asked the questions, Howard. I don't necessarily have the answers.
I tell you what, no, it's a really good way of looking at it, because for me, there's just been, I guess, you know, insular time over the last year or so. That can be the same when we're not going through a pandemic, obviously. But, you know, I felt quite insular. And therefore, yeah, you do kind of become slightly monopolised by minor issues in your own life. When you actually look at the real world, it's probably not as big a deal.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one way of thinking of it. But then I suppose the fact that everybody has a problem might be why we contribute to a problem on a larger global scale. So, you know, Howard, it could be not yourself personally, but maybe everyone else's preoccupation with little minor things and the individualism that kind of follows that might be the reason why we have larger problems on a global scale, because everyone's like, what about me? So
it's like, that's what it's like though, isn't it? It's like raindrops. And then when you get enough raindrops, you get a ocean.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone's individual problems, like what Dane's saying, they all, if you add them all together, then what you've got is you've got like atoms that are just bouncing around, and then when they bump into each other, they explode. And it's all right on a kind of like a personal scale, you know, if it's you in your house, you know, by yourself, not interacting with people. But as soon as you start going out in the world, you know, whatever fucked up, you know, shit that you've been saying to yourself in isolation, you know, telling yourself one thing when in actual fact the opposite is true. Since you go out into the real world, start bashing in with things that are actually, you know, what is it when you've got, when you tie yourself to a chair and then you brainwash yourself. Yeah. So let's just say you've brainwashed yourself and you go out there in the real world and everyone else is kind of like thinking one thing and you're thinking the other thing, and then you're going to sort of like butt heads against people. So maybe it's, is that what you mean, Howard?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of looking at it, because you're like, particularly, like I say, in lockdown, you can, I've developed quite a solid system Nick, of existence. It's quite watertight, actually, now.
Don't tell me. Don't tell me, Howard. Tell the audience.
Well, audience, I wake up at 7:30 every day and I take my son for a walk in his pram about 8 a.m. And then I take him to the swings about 8:30 and then I get him home and by 9:30 he's asleep and then I do exercise. And this can go on. I can go on for quite a while here telling you every hour of the day pretty much. Obviously, I'm going to enter the real world again once this is all over, this pandemic, and they're not going to play by my rules. Things aren't going to work by my rules anymore. So maybe that's my fucking problem, is that I'm just going to end up having to play by the world's rules again, not this own little kingdom I've built here of just, you know, easy living.
So
does that make sense?
You set yourself up living in your own personal Xanadu, yeah. and your fucking problem is that you've got a fucking perfect life, and your problem is the fact that other people have got to kind of come into your life at some point and ruin it.
Well, yeah, that's it. Anyone else?
you know, Howard, I think you'll find most people kind of have that disposition a lot of the time within a capitalist society, is that we are encouraged to be able to create our own piece of heaven, right? And then anything else outside that could disrupt that, we're like, oh my God, no, feeding children? What about me? But yeah, it's a really good question. Do you feel that there is an existential problem you have, Nick, and you're like, this is my problem, this is my complex?
Well, just if you're going to be analytical about what Howard just said, Howard said his problem was other people. Other people was the problem. But in highlighting what his problem is, he's actually highlighted what his problem is. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If he was actually more open-hearted with people and let them in, then maybe all of his problems would go away. Just a thought there. Just a thought there, Harry.
I'm a control freak. That's the obvious, simple explanation of what it is.
I think what we've learned with Harry is he has to let go a little bit, you know?
But Howard,
that for years.
In Howard's defense, his fingers have been burned. he and his people's fingers have been burned by people. I have a quote that I think articulates my problem, Nick. It's by a French philosopher called Alphonse de Lamartine, which I may have me definitely mispronouncing. But
it sounded good, though, mate. It sounded good.
But it's the quote is, "Limited in his nature, infinite in his desire, man is a fallen god who remembers heaven." And that's my fucking problem.
What does that mean to you?
It means that I know better, but I don't always do better. And I guess I can always feel that that I should be a part of something greater. And that's not something materialistic, but I think in my pursuit of something greater that is supposed to be metaphysical, like, I waste time on the material. And
So would you say that you are hyper aware of your own limitations, and that is like your curse? Because if you hadn't known what you're capable of, then you wouldn't. There would be nothing to miss out on. But knowing,
but at the same time, I think that that's almost the disposition of most human beings, and why what we refer to as maybe spirituality or wellness is that there's part of us that realizes, I think there's more to our being than our mortal coil. And sometimes we either do stuff to entrench ourselves within it, if it provides us with comfort in the form of physical gratification, or we try and find ways of leaving it through escapism, whether it's like through use of substances or distractions or, I guess, political identity, and trying to attach ourselves to other ideologies as well. I think we're at a point now where all of the ideologies that have guided us as a society to this point are no longer, they've become obsolete. So it's kind of like, yeah, my problem is, where the fuck do we go now? Because I think we've gone as far as we could go doing what we've been doing.
And Howard, how does Dane's answer make you feel about your answer?
Oh, awful. Yeah, no, terrible. Oh, he's so good. Nick, you're so good at that.
But Howard, you went first, so I had more time to think about my answer.
But that's, you know... Yeah. What's your fucking problem then, Nick? Come on. What are you fucking got here, eh?
I'm all right.
It's really good. Well, that was a good question. You know what? That's perfect. I have to still edit this show. So that was a perfect question. And I'm gonna ask something very different. Do you mind if I switch gear to something like go a bit personal? Is that all right? Is everyone okay? I mean, you can tell me to fuck off if you like.
But we've
done some work with Samaritans recently. You know, that's a cause. You know. Me and Dane both feel strongly about. They were saying some interesting stuff about listening and being a good listener.
Say that again. No, go on.
I can't be serious now. Fuck this. I'm not going to bother. I'll ask my silly question instead.
No, that's the proper question. That's the proper question, Howard.
Right, you've got a choice of two questions. You've either got really fucking serious misery or Jean-Claude Van Damme. What do you want?
I mean, they're both serious to me, but Howard, remember, this is the disposition of the... Howard, the idea of comedy is to stare into the darkest recesses of tragedy and get the comedy out of it. So you can ask a serious question. We'll find a way.
Okay, you won the miserable question, fine. Samaritans were saying to us, you know, it's important to listen. And, you know, people go through really tough times, right? People go through really tough times. So I was going to ask you guys to share with the listeners, as though it might help them going through tough times, to talk about what has been a tough time that you've had that you've managed to ultimately kind of come through. Pretty personal.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I could have just talked about Jean-Claude Van Damme if you want.
What was your Jean-Claude Van Damme question?
Well, I watched Time Cop and I thought, you know what, this is a really good fucking film. And then I looked at the rest of his work and thought, oh, I'm not really sure about Jean-Claude Van Damme's career. Where do we rate Jean-Claude Van Damme in the history of great action movie leaders? Or what's the most depressing thing that's ever happened to you?
To answer your second question first, he's like, he's second tier, isn't he? In that era.
Fine.
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah, you know, fine.
Was he in Expendables?
He was the bad guy in Expendables 2.
And that's, yeah, second, that's pretty good. Sequel, yeah.
He turned down the first one. He turned down Expendables 1 because they hadn't written the script yet.
Okay.
Just for the record, Time Cop, I would say, is genuinely a really good film. Like, I watched
it. Time Cop, along with Hard Target, are both produced by Sam Raimi.
Oh, there really? There you go.
After he did Evil Dead and Army of Darkness and Evil Dead 2 and all of those films, Sam Raimi weirdly produced John Woo's first American movie, and then, including that one, two Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, and then he went back to doing like horror movies and stuff.
I think sci-fi, you know, a bit of time. We love a bit of time travel, don't we? When they do it, it's done. I think it's done well. So,
even the technology at the time, and the awareness at the time, it was done well. I mean, this is because there's like a spectrum in terms of like level of science fiction. Because I do like the Nolan level of scientific theoretical research, but I'm not going to stand here and act like I understood Tenet. I really didn't, but I did like.
I thought Tenet was shit.
Yes, agreed. Agreed.
General consensus.
I thought it was absolute pretentious wank, and there may have been something in there, but my thought is that if you're making a film, just let your audience get on board on the ground floor, and then go crazy. Just tell us what the fucking film's about, and then we can enjoy it. Do what you like after that. But if you don't tell people what your fucking film is about at the beginning of the film, then how the fuck you... I couldn't follow a single fucking thing, and I hated it, and I thought it was pretentious wank. Yeah. That was what I thought of Tenet. And you can say that forward and backwards.
Oh, do you know what? Is that why? Oh, that... Never mind. Thanks, Nick. You put the nail in that coffin for that. Yeah, Van Damme, I'll say he's second tier. I mean...
Second tier, Van Damme second tier.
But for me, I deal with a different tier because I also include Hong Kong film stars and they're like top tier. So for me, it would be like, well, Jet Li and Jackie Chan, of course. But I should probably address your serious question as well, Howard, about Hard Times. So, a difficult time. I would say the point in which before I decided I was going to do stand-up comedy was a very, very, very difficult time for me. In that, I suppose I was going through what I referred to at the time as a quarter-life crisis. In a job I hated, girlfriend had just left me. I was still living at home. My parents on a single bed. Wasn't making much money. I think the credit crunch had just happened as well. And all of these points, I guess, or this, it's all relative. But for me, it was kind of I had tried to put together a plan of what I want to achieve with my life and in line with my ambitions. And it just all fell apart before my eyes. And I remember this, I guess my eyes were open and seeing the world for what it really was. And yeah, I just took a look at, you know, the opportunities my friends were being able to enjoy because of, like, you know, legacy, wealth and, you know, nepotism. And I'm not necessarily using that in a negative way, just describing the phenomenon of, you know, not what you know, it's who you know. And yeah, and I just remember on three occasions at every job I had, people listening to me speak, how I speak to you guys like right now, and they'd be like, oh, you seem to be quite a smart guy, Dane. And I'd be like, okay. They'd go, have you been to university? And I'd be like, yeah, I went to uni. And they'd be like, well, you might have a degree, but I'm always going to be your boss. And I was like, what the fuck? I don't recall having this. I don't even remember bringing it up at all. So it was that kind of experience.
Was that an actual conversation that you had?
Yeah, three times at three different offices. First time.
But that specifically, or is it kind of like, this is the gist of the conversation? This is what they actually said to you.
This is verbatim what they actually said to me. And so, yeah, I just kind of gave me a feel for the, yeah, that's what was corporate culture really. And I guess through those experiences working at a desk, I kind of worked out what the difference between a leader and a manager was. Like when people consider like talking about suicide and stuff like that, I would have said historically I'd have been somebody who was kind of like, why would someone commit suicide or give someone else the power to take their own life for something that happened to them? But suicide, and this is not something I encourage, this is not something I endorse, but I do get it. And I think it's important that people understand that when people feel suicidal, it isn't just a feeling that I want to kill myself. It's more as a part of a social species. If you feel so disconnected from people you're close to and from humanity and society in general, that you don't feel you're able to contribute contribute as part of an organism, as opposed to contributing as part of a machine, you rationalize that maybe I don't need to be here. And I totally get how that feels. And to anyone who feels like that, I would say that, you know, always take the time to practice doing something which reminds you of your humanity. Like, obviously, all organisms need to breathe and reproduce and shit and sleep. But, you know, we have the benefit that we can do things which allow us to chronicle our existence. And, you know, they say you live as long as the last person alive, the last person that remembers you stays alive. And I think the way to ensure that you will have a lasting memory is to be able to imprint on somebody else. Like I said, we're a human species. If you are someone who feels suicidal or feels low, my only The only thing I can say, I can never tell you how to feel. I wouldn't ever presume that you can cheer up just by someone else telling you to. But understanding, nothing else, there's always someone feeling the same way. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't feel that way yourself, but it's just you, there's nothing wrong with you. And not feeling happy and feeling like you've given up and feeling destitute is not a thing that is unique to any individual. We all kind of feel that way. And
yeah. Well, that's why I wanted to ask this question, really, because it's definitely one of those things that, God, people feel alone out there, right? What did come to mind when you think of that question, Nick?
I was just going to let Dane talk until we ran out of time. I was like,
because you've got to listen to Nick.
It's a really personal. It's a really personal thing with me. I've always what was the question? Because I thought Dane's answer was incredible, but what was the question?
What was it? One of your lowest points that you would share with people to kind of, you know, what is one of your lowest points that you remember that's good to share with people to show that you came through it? You know, I suppose is the way I phrased it.
I try and think of moods and life like the ocean, and you know, and you just have to ride the waves. And it's like what Dane was saying. It's kind of like, and this year hasn't helped either, you know, I'm quite lucky in the sense that I enjoy my own company, or I can switch off my own company. And I can kind of like put myself in a catatonic state and get through every day, and I don't get under my own feet too much. But if I was with sort of like housemates or a family, or, you know, if my situations were different, then I don't know how I'd have dealt with the last year. But I'm also sort of like very hard on myself, and I don't get on with myself sometimes either. So this is a very complicated thing to talk about, but I've always had depression since I was very tiny, and I go through sort of like waves of feeling good about myself, or feeling good and then feeling bad, and then feeling good and then feeling bad. And once a decade, I probably will hit absolute rock bottom, where you know, you're waves upon waves upon waves, and when you hit rock bottom, it's kind of like I felt very bad very recently, and I sort of remember that the last time I felt this bad was about maybe about 7 years ago, and then the last time I felt this bad was maybe like 10 years before that. And so I do remember these times where they're the very worst. And the thing is, I also remember coming out of them. And I go to therapy, and I think it's important. What I would say is, it's important to talk to people about how you are feeling. And I remember that the reason I got a therapist in the first place was because I felt like I was boring the actual shit out of everyone that I felt like I'd ran out of friends to talk to, yeah, because I was struggling so much that I wouldn't have social events. I wouldn't have like social occasions. They'd all be just me like clutching onto someone for help, just sort of like, I don't know what's going on with me. I don't know what's wrong with me. So I got a therapist is one place that sort of like, on Thursdays, I pile all of my shit onto Thursday afternoon, and then the rest of the week I can sort of function. That works. Sometimes that doesn't work. But what I would say is, I've been seeing the same therapist for a few years, and recently I've been really struggling, and I talked to my therapist, and I was like rock bottom, you know, suicidal thoughts, felt like I don't have any purpose, felt like everything that I've achieved with my life is pointless. I just felt like everything that I've contributed has been shit and worthless, and everything that I could potentially contribute is not worth my time and certainly not worth yours. So, you know, you have these things, and you talk, and, you know, you think to yourself that this is actually rock bottom, this is actually the worst I've ever felt. And it's more complicated than that. I'm paraphrasing, you know. So I'm trying to make this as entertaining as possible. But but you hit rock bottom, right? And then I talked to my therapist, and I was just like, well, this is how I'm feeling. And her take on it was that I am doing so much better than I was 3 years ago.
And that's cool.
For me, I'm like going, this is how I'm feeling right now, immediately, in the moment. And for her, she's like saying, yes, but 3 years ago, I feel that you were worse than this, and I feel like you have gained so many skills. And the fact of the matter is, you turn up for therapy every week, and now I'm going to stop talking about the therapist, but from my point of view, I turn up for therapy every week. I try and eat properly. I've stopped drinking. I don't smoke. You know, and I used to not an alcoholic, but I used to drink a lot, and I used to enjoy smoking with that. So I've kind of like, I'm doing these things. So every day I get up and I'm trying, but maybe I take that for granted a little bit of the stuff that I am doing. And that just becomes part of me. Like being kind. I mean, it's kind of like one of those things where there was a guy in the street. And he was, it was weird. I went past him. I was going to the shop that was on the corner, and I went past him, and he said, could you get me a Coke? He said, can you get me a Diet Coke? And my instinct was just going, that's fucking specific, you know, that you want a Diet Coke. I'll give you some money. You know, he's not asking for money. He's asking specifically for a Diet Coke. So I was just like, my instinct was to go, I'm not going to get you a fucking Coke. And then literally I went through this very complicated thought process within about three nanoseconds, which is kind of like, well, he's not asking for money. Well, he's not going to spend the money on drugs because he just wants a Coke. All he wants is a Coke. In actual fact, it's a lot easier because he's made this a very easy transaction. I don't have any change on me either, so I can't really give him any money. But what I am going to the shop. So I just got him a Coke and I gave him the thing. Now, my instinct wasn't the nice thing, which is, yeah, of course, I'll give you a fucking Coke, mate. But I got there very quickly, and I say I'm a bad person because I even doubted whether he wanted a Coke. Whereas eventually, very quickly, I got to the point of like saying, no, okay, I'll get him a Coke. So I got him a Coke, but I was ages in that shop. And when I came out, he was still there, and I was sort of like, here's the Coke. And he could not fucking believe that someone had got him a Coke.
That's amazing.
And that made me feel sort of like, I don't feel like I fixed his life, obviously, but it's like I always believe in small or large or random acts of kindness. And I don't know, if I have a good experience with someone in a taxi, you know, I'm getting a taxi or an Uber, you have a good exchange with the person in the Uber and you're upbeat. Well, I was in an Uber the other day. The driver was going through a narrow bit. A guy shouted at him and swore at him. And the guy, you know, and I'm a person and I wouldn't like to be shouted at, especially not in front of like my passengers. And I was just like, so I just sort of like chatted to him and I said, ah, he's an idiot. And I made him feel better. And then we got to the destination and then that driver's going to go on. And rather than feel shit about the fact he was shouted at, he'll feel good about the fact that he had a good positive exchange with someone. And that's what I think. And I just think that you look at your career, you look at your life, you look at where you aren't the best person to judge any of that.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
You're not the best person to judge how your career is going. You're not the best person to judge how your life is and how your mood is and all of this. And sometimes you need a third person. And I like to discuss how I'm feeling with people that are close to me. And I also like to help people if they're feeling bad. And I think that is the secret to life. And it's sort of like it's all waves. You might be feeling shit, but you just got to remember that it's a wave. And you might be feeling great, like what Dane said, and you will come back down again. But it's a case of like being prepared for that and not being shocked every single time and enjoying the highs while you get them.
Yeah, and appreciating the lows as well. I just wanted to pick on one thing you said, Nick, because I think that was a really great answer. Because you said, these are the things I'm trying, and this is how people think feel like I'm doing. And it's really two important uses of that verb, because it's saying like trying is like you're doing something maybe when it feels like it's not working, whereas doing it means like you'd be dynamically and actively involved in something. And it's good because it means like, based on the feedback from your therapist, even they understand that as a human being, there is no finite state that you stay in. Just like you said with like the whole waves, is that like as a being, like there is like even the thought process of buying somebody a Coke, there's a being of like trepidation and then, you know, altruism and then fear and then happiness. And then, yeah, so even in that small exchange, it's to understand that, you know, there's a reason why we refer to it as a stream of consciousness, because like we use all of these kind of aquatic adjectives to describe our moods, because you said it's like waves and troughs and we crash and we come down rock bottom. He's obviously at the bottom of the sea. And so it's important that it's like, you know, I think that's the idea, is that we need to learn just, yeah, learn how to ride the wave. And you know, and you know, we say wavelength as well when we're able to connect with somebody in a metaphysical way. So there's a reason why we have all of these kind of ways that I think this is the way we're supposed to connect. And I would say that's the best answer I could ever hear, is like, you know, the way is to connect with other people. It's like, you know, spiritual people believe the soul is forged in suffering. Well, then for those of you who may be suffering, then that is an indication that there is something more to you than just your human body. And, you know,
well, it's, I'm very pleased that we didn't just talk about Jean-Claude Van Damme. It's time for Dane's question, but I'm so glad we got to talk about that stuff. And I hope it helps someone out there.
My final question, Nick, relates to a very cool and awkward event, which I hope is not too painful to discuss. But Nick had a performance at Live at the Apollo. Now, to those who those who are otherwise uninitiated, right, would have seen that Nick may have struggled at Live at the Apollo. Those of us who do comedy, could all give a resounding, happens to all of us all the time. Doesn't matter where or when. Everybody bombs. Now, some people arguing bombing at Live at the Apollo must be the worst thing. Bombing is bad in general. However, I feel like you're not a real comic unless it's happened to you at least once. Because how can you be a jockey if you don't know what it's like to fall off of a horse? Or how can you be a boxer if you don't know what it's like to take a punch in the face? That doesn't necessarily mean it gets easier all the time. But my question was, really, Nick, how do you normally deal with bombing, and how important do you think bombing is to comedy?
How? I think it's the most important thing.
Yeah. Yep.
Agreed. I just honestly, if you don't know what doesn't work, how do you know what does? And if you've never died on your ass, then it's been luck up till now.
Yeah. You've been a politician and you've just said what people want to hear. And in which case, you're not really an artist, are you? So
I think the Live at the Apollo thing is interesting. It's a 3,000 venue. It's a 3,000 person venue. 1,000 people walked out. And you go, which I found out in the Sun the next day. The Sun, so many people had walked out that it was one of those little points of interest that they have in the Sun. And they phoned me up and they wanted me to comment on it. And then, you know, it was like hyenas. Everyone was like, everyone was phoning up, kind of like, oh God, what has Nick got to say about it? And you just like, I no comment. So I didn't talk about it at the time. And then a bit later on, I did Joel Dommett's podcast. And by that point, I'd got the experience. And this is sort of like an answer to the second question as well. Mm-hmm. It was obviously like this terrible experience where, as a child, as a young kid, you know, I grew up watching stand-up on TV whenever it was. It was rare, but whenever it was on TV, I'd watch it. And then when Jack D started doing Live at the Apollo in the early 2000s, I was a huge Jack D fan. Like, he's my favorite comedian when I was a teenager. And so, you know, I didn't know I wanted to be a stand-up comedian, but I used to love stand-up. And then when I started doing stand-up, you just like, oh, finally, I finally found the thing that I love doing. And, you know, you start making friends with other comedians and with other people in the industry because, you know, you've all got like a joint interest in everything. And you kind of, I'm finally accepted. And then to be asked to do Live at the Apollo is this amazing kind of like honor. It's like, if you are just a stand, if you are a straight stand-up comedian, if you're just a stand-up comedian, if you're a straight stand-up comedian, you just do stand-up, no acting, nothing else on the side, then doing Live at the Apollo is pretty much the height of what you can do in this country.
It's like playing in Wembley as an English footballer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you have like, so when you go to do it, it was a really weird day because I was very relaxed and I'm normally very nervous about stuff, but I'd worked on the material. I was on tour at the time and I would do, I put aside a 20 minutes section of that show to literally work on my Apollo set. And so I knew what it was. And then a friend of mine came to see me and he said, is that what you're doing? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I wouldn't do that. So I changed it at the last minute. And I still thought it was pretty good, but I changed it. I do songs and poems as well. So they're a little bit like Lego bricks where you can kind of like swap them around. Mm-hmm. And then when you do Live at the Apollo, it's like doing Stars in Their Eyes, where there's loads of smoke, the thing comes up, and you walk through this billow of smoke and there's all these lights on you. And I came out and Roisin had just been on before me and Russell Kane was comparing. And we were the second show. I think the first show that was recorded that night in front of the same audience was Jason Byrne. Ramesh was comparing. And there was another comedian. Stuart Francis was on.
Right.
So it'd been a long night. And I think Roisin had fallen over her shoe and had to start again. Right. And everyone in the audience was like, you can do it, Roisin. And so she was like, oh, the audience fucking loved her, right? And then I came out and I do one of my jokes and no one laughs. And I go, what's your fucking problem? And the whole audience instantly are just like, well, you're not Roisin. And she fell over and she had the, you know, the common decency to look embarrassed. And you've come out and you've told her. It's like, this is my act. So my act is exactly the same if it's going well or if it's going badly, right?
Yep.
If it's going well, I get angrier with the audience. If it's going badly, it's just like, well, what the fuck am I meant to do? I'm still going to do the act. Like, I haven't just walked onto Live at the Apollo with no experience. Like, this is it. There's 3,000 people that hated me. I had like a little routine about it where it's like my mum was sat like eye level in the stalls and she had her like face covered with her hands just like in horror. She was just like exactly eye level, halfway up in the stalls, exactly eye level. And I was like, you know, I wrote material about it, which was, you know, yeah. Oh, 1,000 people walked out. Do you know how embarrassing that is? My mum and dad were in. Well, they were at first. You know, it's like that. In my head, just before you walk onto the stage, you think, yeah, great. This is going to be brilliant. This is Live at the Apollo. This is what I've worked my whole life for. And then as soon as you step through, you know, the smoke and you're confronted with the audience and you do your first joke and they don't like it, you go, oh yeah, I'm Nick Helm. They're going to hate me. and so you do it. And I thought for a start, I thought the audience were incredibly rude because they knew it was being filmed and they were all getting up and leaving. And I thought, what a bunch of pricks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really proud of that, that thing, that Live at the Apollo, because it looks like if I'm not enjoying it, it looks like at least I'm doing it.
Absolutely.
I'm just going to say, you know, there's so much editing, not to say that there aren't brilliant comedians who have nice gigs on Live at the Apollo. There's so much editing that goes on. It's such a bizarre thing anyway, because live comedy is such a thing. And there's nothing, I can tell you, I've been watching comedy for many, many years. There is nothing compared to watching Nick live.
Absolutely.
It is a wonderful experience seeing you. Nick, one of my favourite ever memories of comedy is going to see you do a preview of a show in a basement in Aces and Eights in Kentish Town. And the guy welcomes you onto the stage and you walk out and this guy just next to the stage just whoops. He just goes, Danny literally just goes, woo! And Nick just stops and just rips into this guy for five, honestly.
I feel like I was there.
Absolutely rips into this guy for ruining everything. We haven't even started and you ruined it all. And it was, honestly, I enjoyed myself. So Nick, you know, fuck it, Nick. These things happen.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. And I think it's interesting because the elevated peril or tragedy is only because of the venue that it happened at.
They were such a bunch of thick, stupid, lazy cunts in that audience. I'm surprised a thousand of them even had the fucking intelligence to get up and fucking walk out. So I don't mind. I think it's exactly. I've had people walk out on me before. In Edinburgh, it was a badge of honour. I got a 5-star Edinburgh Award nominated show. And I came out the day after I got a 5-star review. And
it's the worst.
Packed.
It's always the worst.
And it's always the worst. And within 30 seconds, the entire front row had ran out in terror, right? And you're just like, I think for some people, it's kind of like having a bad gig must be the most embarrassing thing in the world. If you don't do comedy, it's like, oh my God, it must be, oh no. Must be the most embarrassing thing in the world. It's just like, no, I'm embarrassed for you because you're not laughing. you obviously don't get any of my jokes. So it's like, I don't know, but it was really weird. It was a really proud moment. As I walked off the stage, I looked at the clock and I think, I can't remember how long you're meant to do. It's something like you're meant to do like 15 minutes. And I remember looking at this red like digital clock on the front of the stage as I was walking off and it said 15:02, and I was like, I've done my time. I just walked off.
That's it.
Nobody looked at me. You know, the makeup women, they ignored me. All of the other acts ignored me. I was with my parents. It was the day before my birthday. I was with my parents. I was just like, I don't know what I meant to fucking do. Like, everyone's ignoring me because I've died, but I was also on last and everyone wanted to get the tubes. And let's face it, it's not like Russell Kane is famous for not talking a lot. And it was like...
great friend of the podcast, by the way. We all love you, Russell.
So it's kind of like you go, well, what the fuck am I going to do? So me and my, I was with my parents, and so I had to go into the green room. I was just like, I can either go home and not show my face, or I've got to go into the bar and at least show my face, and then I'll leave. So I went into the bar. Nobody talked to me, And then me and my parents were stood in the corner just having a drink, and everyone knew that it had gone badly. And then Roisin just came over to me, and she started chatting. And then you go, oh, amazing. And then we left. And then it was my birthday, very awkward dinner that we had for my birthday the next day. But it was just like, well, is it? Oh, I did it on Joel Dommett's podcast, and then it kind of like got released. He released his podcast like 2 days before Live at the Apollo came on TV. And then Chortle wrote an article about it, like I'd given them an exclusive interview. And then people from all over the industry were like either messaging me saying, well done, good for you on blowing the whistle on Live at the Apollo. And then you had people in chat rooms that were saying that I was always a shit comedian and this is what happens when shit comedians go on TV. And you're just there going like, wow, I'm getting like the perspective from everyone when in actual fact, I didn't do anything clever. I just went on, did my act. I did it as well as I could. Yeah. And when you watch it back, I did fine. So it's just one of those things. But and I think that at the time it was difficult for people to watch it because I'd done Joel's podcast and then Chortle wrote that article. It's difficult for people to watch it without the aware, you know, without being aware.
Without the bias, yeah, I suppose, but
had I never talked to Joel and he hadn't stitched me up, then People would have thought, especially, I know what I was going to say. I'm going to say, when you're doing Live at the Apollo, it's a TV show. Ooh. And it's only a little bit of a live performance. The live stuff is to give you an idea of the fact that there's an audience.
Yeah.
It looks very luxurious.
It's more for ambience than anything else, like for the live audience.
They're a prop. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, look at how big this fucking venue is. And then it's a TV show. I went to see a couple of my friends record a DVD at the Apollo. And the whole time, it went fine. It didn't go amazing, didn't go badly. But the whole time, people were just getting up and going to the toilet and then coming back and sitting down again. And then other people were getting up and going to the toilet. And you kind of like go, all fine. I enjoyed it. I'm proud of myself.
Yeah. No, I most definitely should be, I think. It's like you
and
said.
Why did you bring it up, Dane? Why did you bring it up?
Because I wanted to let you know, Nick, that was also 3 years ago plus, and you have come forward in leaps and bounds again. And also because it's like you said, the way that comedy's fans and audience members and critics were kind of polarized over something like that, like it shows you the power of the art form that we're doing. Because, you know, if you was doing a Vanilla Bland thing that kind of laughed and was along the same lines as what people are used to hearing, it would have probably been like, well done, Nick, and then faded into obscurity. Like, people who know you and your body of work know what you're capable of, and you have, you know, a litany of other achievements aside of that. So if you have this one blip which was able to cause people like Chortle to get involved and all of these like online critics to get involved, it goes to show you why it's important that you be yourself when it comes to performing. Because I bombed in an auditorium at Brunel University, and literally people were chanting in unison, please pass the mic. And, you know, I've had people try to boo me off stage. And I know having that experience has given me a distinct advantage over a lot of my peers, because I knew if I can come back from this when a whole room of people are trying to boo me off stage, then, you know, how bad can the next one be? It's like, you know, I love this art form and I have to accept that bombing is a part of it. And the first cut's always the deepest, isn't it? So, yeah. I bombed in other ways since then and stuff. But the important thing was is that, you know, that you've continued to be yourself and continue to stick to your art form. And like I said, I just don't think, like, with an art form, if you are doing something that is universally enjoyed by everybody, then what could you, like, I don't know what you could possibly be doing. There's like the only thing that people like something that everyone takes involves doing is breathing. So if you're just as relevant as like air, then. But I just think that, you know, it's an example whereby even in the pursuit of something you love more than anything, there's going to be like crests and troughs there as well. And those don't define you or your career. And it's the same thing with real life as well. There's going to be parts where you're like, fucking hell, life is shit. But that's not going to define who you are. So that's why I wanted to ask you about it, because it's like, you know, like you said, the event is very similar to like, you know, coping with your emotions and stuff as well. And it's all about, and this all contributes towards resilience. So.
Sadly, we could talk about this for ages, but we have run out of time today. But it's been a brilliant, brilliant episode, isn't it, Dane? What a guest Nick Helm was.
Absolutely. No, and there's no doubt in our mind. And, you know, I think, you know, given the stories we discussed, people know what it takes to make a comedian of this caliber. So again, Mr. Nick Helm, thank you so much. Yeah. And Nick, again, thank you so much for being a friend when I didn't know anybody. And, I never take it lightly when, you know, people take time to be kind. A random act of kindness, which I remember to this day. So, you know, mission accomplished in that one, mate.
Oh, fucking hell, mate. You've just tied the entire thing together. If you'd have said something about mayonnaise as well, and I just thought you were a god.
Well, I mean, it's... Very good. Well, today on the 7th of May, your nays, we've recorded. So that's just what I'm going to get.
You went and fucking fucked it, Dane.
Oh, we can't bomb anymore, Nick. I thought we could still bomb, Nick. That was the whole thing. I bombed Nick.
Oh, man.
And I'm not sorry.
Not like that.
It was a beautiful experience for all. I'm sure the listeners enjoyed it immensely.
Absolutely. And Nick, if you could please tell our audience members where you can find out about your good works. And yeah. We'd be very grateful. Thank you. Both musical and comedic. And both.
I think you can get... I've got some studio albums, and there's the Uncle soundtrack. Uncle's on Netflix, and Loaded is on Netflix, and Eat Your Heart Out's on Dave. I don't know, watch them. Oh, my show, Phoenix from the Flames, is out on Go Faster Strike, and you can download it from there. And it's good.
Yeah, it is good. I've seen it. I enjoyed it immensely.
It's good. And I hope to those of you listening, you can see, as Nick has told you, that even someone of that calibre, who is well-regarded and respected within his art form, experiences severe depression as well. So the most important thing is to understand that it's a cliche, but it's okay to not be okay. And personally, I always feel like if you weren't depressed every now and again, you ain't paying any fucking attention. But just remember that that's not the entirety of your being. It's waves, and you just learn to ride them, guys. And if you ever want to have a question about, you know, your existence, you can always message this podcast as well. So
absolutely. Thanks again, Nick.
Thank you very much, Nick.
A joy.
What a good podcast.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Nick Helm. You can follow Nick on Twitter and Instagram at TheNickHelm. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQEPodcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.